The title of my presentation today is The Art of ART Initiation, Clinician Perspectives on Prescribing Antiretroviral Therapy. And that's me, and I have no financial relationships to disclose. A little bit of background, and I think everybody in this room is probably aware of this, but ART does dramatically reduce HIV-associated morbidity and mortality and substantially decreases perinatal and sexual transmission. In 2013, the Department of Health and Human Services revised their guidelines to recommend a universal offer of ART for all HIV-positive individuals. This is already mentioned here this afternoon. I do want to note that this is a recommendation or a policy that has been in place in San Francisco, where I am from, since 2010. And while in general, providers in San Francisco have increased the number of patients that they start earlier on ART, rates do vary among certain subgroups, such as African Americans, injection drug using MSM, and people over the age of 50. So I think this is probably familiar to most people in this room. This is the HIV care continuum. And normally, treatment initiation falls right after engagement in care. But I think that we all know in life, not all patients follow this linear path in their HIV journey. So really, treatment initiation can fall anywhere after diagnosis, and obviously before they reach viral suppression. And so the purpose of our project was to talk with clinicians in San Francisco with prescribing privileges and to figure out when and how they make the decision to offer ART to their patients, what they identify as facilitators and barriers to early initiation of ART, and how they define and assess the concept of treatment readiness. Our methods. So we conducted 7 focus groups. Each group contained between 3 and 5 providers. We talked with a total of 20 providers. And I should mention that we did the groups in the fall of 2013, so 2 years ago at this point. Participants included medical doctors, obviously, but also nurse practitioners and physician assistants, anyone who had prescribing privileges. And they worked in either private practice or public clinics in San Francisco. We audio recorded every single group. We had them just transcribe verbatim, and then we analyzed the data at the Department of Public Health. This is our qualitative analysis plan. For those of you who are familiar with qualitative analysis, this is a thematic analysis. But for those of you who aren't, I'll just run through it briefly. On an individual basis, we read through each transcript to pull out themes, and then we met as a group to compare themes and what we decided were the themes within the text. Once we agreed upon the overarching themes or umbrellas that were mentioned by each of the providers in each of the groups, we assigned codes to those themes, and then working in pairs, so two people per transcript, we coded each line in the transcript based on what we had assigned as the thematic code. And then we gathered our findings and disseminated them, as I am doing today. We did not use software for this. So some of you may know that there's now beautiful qualitative software available. We did not use that. We used the old-fashioned pen and paper and whiteboard. This is a picture of one of our whiteboards from one of our many meetings. You can see the green marker were the findings, and then circled were the themes that we pulled out. So it was definitely not a low-tech endeavor. I like to say it was kind of the quick and dirty method, but it was not quick and maybe just a little bit dirty. So here's a description of who participated in the groups. Most were MDs. Most were between the ages of 51 and 60 years old. And it was a pretty good mix between those who worked in public clinics versus private practice. So we were glad about that, although more did work in public settings. The overwhelming majority were HIV/AIDS specialists. They had more than 10 years of practice, and they averaged more than 10 patients per month. So the first thing we did at the beginning of every focus group was to ask them what they perceived were the facilitators and barriers to early initiation of ART. And so this was kind of a brain dump, and we got a lot of information. Some of it is here. I think the most common things that were mentioned are here. The facilitators are on the left and the barriers are on the right, and I think we touched on some of these already today in the other presentations, but just to read through some of them. So some facilitators, clear guidelines were helpful in deciding when to treat. More data and research was also helpful to clinicians. On-site support systems, such as pharmacists and social workers, enhanced access to social services such as housing and substance use treatment. Emergency ADAP was mentioned as a facilitator to getting started on ART. The Affordable Care Act. As a reminder, I collected this data in 2013, so it was right before the rollout of the Affordable Care Act. And so they were really feeling hopeful that more people would have access to insurance, which would help. High viral load and low CD4. So obviously if somebody has an extremely high viral load, you want to treat right away. Acute HIV infection was another facilitator. And then of course the patient being ready and willing to start was a big one. Barriers are basically the opposite of the facilitators. And those included things like substance use, mental health issues, stigma, of course lack of access to care and medications, lack of health insurance, and then any kind of personal beliefs or suspicions, either about doctors and the medical community or the meds themselves, and any kind of fear of side effects. Maybe they were in denial of their diagnosis, they did not have a good relationship with their provider, low health literacy, and of course high CD4 and low viral load, because historically clinicians did not treat patients who had high CD4 and low viral load. And of course, if the patient just wasn't ready to start for whatever reason, that's a barrier. So then we asked them, what are reasons that you specifically prescribe immediate ART? What are some clinical reasons? And the themes that emerged, there were four themes that emerged from this question. One was urgent health concerns. Another was treatment during acute opportunistic infections. Another was long-term health benefits. And then, of course, reduced transmission risk was also mentioned many times. So urgent health concerns such as low CD4 count, high viral load, acute HIV infection, and then perhaps comorbidities such as hepatitis, diabetes, and heart disease. And according to this one participant, who said, if this is acute infection, then I think there's no need to waste a single day. So treatment during acute opportunistic infections, this was another theme that emerged from this question. And according to this participant, initiating ART at the same time as acute opportunistic infection treatment rather than waiting, we know that initiating at the same time actually has mortality benefit. Most of our participants felt this way, although there were some outliers, like this person who felt that when dealing with a febrile illness, it's a bad idea to start him on any kind of medications to not confuse the febrile illness with an allergic reaction. Long-term health benefits, such as reducing latent reservoir, reducing chronic inflammation, and delaying the onset of non-AIDS comorbidities, was also a theme that emerged. And this provider felt that treating patients in the acute phase will decrease the size of their latent reservoir to prevent it from becoming well established and potentially improve chances for cure down the road. Another one said, when I absolutely start without a genotype would be with someone in hyperacute phase where minutes equal long-term immunity. And then finally, another reason why they would begin immediate ART with their patients included reduced transmission risk. And of course, this is transmission risk to partners, but then also community viral load was mentioned. And this provider said, I always say, you know, if you have an HIV negative partner and you are having unprotected sex, to me, beginning ART treatment is a no-brainer. And I think decreasing the community viral load is really, really important. But there was emphasis in making this more of a secondary benefit in their conversations with patients, and that the primary benefit for them to start ART was for themselves and as an individual, and the reduced transmission risk was really a secondary benefit. As this person states, treatment is for them first. The fact that this person has a negative partner, it's a secondary benefit, but I would not make it the focus of my visit. Along the reduced transmission risk lines, all participants talked about how they speak about PEP and or PrEP with their newly diagnosed patients. As this one says, the partner could be offered a choice of PrEP if this positive partner is not willing or wanting to go on meds for some reason. So next we asked them about how they defined treatment readiness. And four themes emerged from this question. One was having access to medications. Two was the ability to adhere to the regimen. And three, patient perceptions and knowledge. And then the last one was what support systems are in place for any particular patient. If the patient isn't prepared and in agreement that he needs to take his medicine every day, treatment will fail, and you don't want to set up the patient for failure. So access to medications, this is a quote from somebody working in one of our public clinics, and they stress that, you know, we have really great access to medications in San Francisco. Of course, we have ADAP, but we also had, at the time, Healthy San Francisco and now ACA. And they felt that, quote, we're pretty well set up to provide some kind of funding for the treatment of people who don't have Medi-Cal or some other form of insurance. Kind of conversely, somebody in private practice said that with ACA, I hope there will be fewer responses to my prescriptions from insurance companies that patients need prior authorizations, and there are fewer challenges to my prescription recommendations for patients. Ability to adhere to the regimen was a big one, and you know that's been touched on again earlier by my co-presenters. But one provider said, because you know you may not want them to burn their last bridge, and if they are really not ready, then you may be doing them a disservice to put them on something and then develop resistance. So, you know, the fear of developing resistance to any particular regimen was definitely a concern among the clinicians that we spoke with. And then, does addiction make their life chaotic? Does it make it hard for them to remember to take pills? Really, the repercussions of not being able to take these on a daily regimen, that you have to be very regimented, and what happens if you start missing, and that sometimes influences the regimen I choose. And then, of course, patient perceptions of either the ART itself or the medical community and their knowledge, whether it be from community members, friends, or the internet, that certainly impacts their willingness to start. And so according to this first participant or provider participant here, I think in many cases they have friends who are on treatment and who are doing well on treatment. There is a lot less vitriol in HIV-related or gay-related publications than there might have been a few years ago about treatment. And so this certainly has helped facilitate earlier initiation of ART. And then another one said something very interesting about the word cocktail. I think that has been used historically to describe ART, especially in the 90s. And I think she says here, I think the word cocktail has been harmful because some people feel like it's not, somehow it has this like non-medical sense that it's experimental and not quite medicine. Support systems were a big part of treatment readiness. So support systems included friends, family, and if there was stigma associated within the community that the patient was living. Are they going to have to hide their pills? Are they living somewhere where nobody knows about their diagnosis? is that going to be a barrier? Structural supports, especially housing, psychological services, or substance use treatment, that was all related to treatment readiness. And this provider says, if they're, say, going to a methadone clinic or something, and they have someone they're engaged with from a mental health standpoint, or trying to utilize multiple resources and multiple providers with the patient's permission, can we be in communication with those other people? I think that would be very helpful. Support groups such as treatment adherence buddies, they said that would be extremely helpful. I think that some of the things that can be helpful or successful are peer navigators or treatment adherence buddies. Often I think these patients don't know how to or don't want to ask their provider or are afraid to ask, but they are comfortable asking other peers, like, what's this pill like? What does it do? How should I take it? And then finally, around support systems, benefits of public health workers such as pharmacists, social workers, and peer navigators. The pharmacists, social workers, additional nurses, nurse specialists, all of these can be helpful to educate patients. A quote from somebody working in the private sector in a private practice said, we really don't have these things in the private sector, so the onus is on us to ensure that the patients understand the side effects of the medicines. So we asked about same-day treatments, and this is really where we had an interesting split between practitioners practicing in public clinics versus those in private practice. On the left, we have some quotes from providers in our public clinics. In general, I would start as soon as possible just to retain what is present already so that we don't have further deterioration while we're waiting. And just to be clear, same-day treatment would be treatment on the day of diagnosis. That's how we explained it to our participants. And then another provider from the public clinic said, even if you're worried about transmitted drug resistance, you can build a regimen to take care of that and make adjustments later when you get the genotype. However, pretty much every provider that we spoke with in a private practice had serious hesitations about day of diagnosis treatment, and that's illustrated here on the right. A positive antibody test at day of diagnosis, for me, would rarely ever lead to treatment. I would need at least viral load before I would start. And then another one said, I think I'm having a problem with day of diagnosis. I think it is too soon. I think somebody needs to, take a deep breath. So along these lines of day diagnosis starting, we asked about ART starter packs. So these would be an initial regimen of, say, 5 to 7 days. It would come in a bubble pack, and we asked providers if they thought that would be a good idea. And most did. Most agreed that that would be a great idea. I think it is a lot to process, and so if you already had a bubble pack or a Medi set, it would probably increase the chances of taking them correctly. If you don't have to go to the pharmacy for the first time, they are just there, and that is one less barrier. But not everybody was on board with ART starter packs. This clinician here said it's better to have them get the whole amount so that we know that they're not going to get 7 days and then still have this problem. And I think this problem is not being able to access meds through a pharmacy, and then have to stop because they couldn't continue the full prescription. And then finally, we asked them what they felt about patient-provider relationship and the importance of that. And they all agreed that it was extremely important to build trust with your patients and to consider your patient as an ally and an equal participant in the decision to start treatment. And according to this clinician, the patient needs to be an equal participant in the decision-making process. That patient deserves that. And here's a good example of exactly how this clinician talks about treatment with his patients. Both visit number one and visit number two, I went over the whole adherence issue and pursued it at different angles. How will you accomplish this? We spent a little time going over virologic resistance, and then visit number three, when we have the resistance test back, we can finally make a selection of an ART regimen. And then clinicians spoke of the importance of normalizing an HIV diagnosis. And this one said, I think I say this at every single visit, Whether I start people that day or not, I say, I expect you to have a completely normal and healthy life. So I just want to say in closing, you know, immediate ART is a key strategy in the plan to eradicate new infections in San Francisco. San Francisco started their Getting to Zero initiative about a year ago, so zero new infections, zero HIV-related deaths, and zero stigma by 2020, which is a very ambitious initiative. And of course, zero new infections depends largely on access to treatment for people who have HIV and then also reducing the risk of transmitting it in the community. And around that, clinicians' beliefs and practices for prescribing ART impact the scope and the effectiveness of the Getting to Zero strategy. So while we didn't talk to very many clinicians, only 20, and our findings therefore are not generalizable to a larger population of all clinicians in San Francisco, we did glean some interesting and useful information about practice for prescribing ART. And we do feel that the information that we have gathered helped to formulate the Getting to Zero initiative around reducing transmission to zero, and that we should provide resources to help train clinicians in the community and maybe CE classes on the benefits of starting ART earlier, and of course support patients who choose to begin treatment right away after their diagnosis. Just some acknowledgments. These were our collaborators for the project, and of course a big thank you to the clinicians who gave their time and insights for this project. Thank you.
I'd like to leave the panel open for questions for our presenters.
I have a question for housing works. So what percentage of the clients were homeless during this time?
As Ali said, is that the snapshot, for example, and I don't know exactly how many were homeless. What I would say is that most of our patients, this is the patient population that we have is homeless or formerly homeless, but we do have, when we want patients engaging care with us, we do everything to put them in housing. So we actually do not have a very high percentage of currently homeless patients on a day-to-day basis. People come to us, and because we have our own housing, we either emergency housing, so we always, once people come to us, it's very short time. They might be homeless for a week or two, but a month at the most. So I hope that can take over.
So we put this data broken out by what program their team members in, and our housing program has had some of the biggest successes of any of the programs, and they sort of tailored the program in a way that is unique because we have a lot of congregate housing facilities that are transitional, and the staff who are there on site during the day have started doing what we're calling unofficial DOT, where they're checking in, you know, knocking on the door every day. And they just sort of started doing that on their own. So they're not coming to the point that they need the nurse for DOT, but there's someone in the building who's checking in on them every day, taking their meds, and not just their immune meds, but all their meds. So housing has actually been really successful for
us. So most of them were in the transitional housing.
Yeah, and I would say that housing is one of the part of housing work that pushed us to do that, because our numbers were not good. And we were very concerned about that years back, and they were part of the driver for that intervention.
I have a couple questions for Aaron. I was just wondering, how did you get the clinician to participate in the discussion groups with any kind of incentive or anything like that? And also, has there been any thought of, I know it's necessary a critical mass of HIV clinicians, but was there any thought of discussions with non-HIV providers who might be able to provide that?
So, in answer to your first question, it was definitely a convenient sample. We did one kind of recruitment event where we went to an IAS report class that was held on the campus of UCSF, but it was open to all providers in the community, not just UCSF. And we had a table, and we explained what we intended to do and asked them to sign a list if they were interested in participating. For some of our private practices, we did, builder reach out to them, calling them and explaining what we intended to do, asking if they were interested in participating. So, it was, we worked closely with our collaborators and had them refer clinicians that they thought would be interested in participating, and we reached out directly to them. We did offer an incentive. It was lunch if the group happened to be around lunch time, which most were. And then also we gave each a $30 Amazon gift card. And then your second question was, can you repeat it for me?
Was there any thought given to only the discussion with
Yeah, so we specifically require that they specialize in HIV. It just so happened that most that we spoke with considered themselves HIV specialists. But all of them, I think the remaining ones that didn't were infectious disease doctors, and so we didn't necessarily exclude those who weren't, but I think that our recruitment methods just lended itself to that best that we got. And then also the majority, most of them saw upwards of 10 patients a month. So.
Do we have the questions for the group? If you have other questions or want to speak with them in person, they'll be here for you for the remaining time. We have this room until 4 o'clock. Thank you very much to our speakers.